national news from a grassroots perspective. You are listening to Groundwire, community news from coast to coast to coast.
Today on Groundwire.
And I was really concerned with their involvement in any way with the Canadian government.
This time, for the first time, I'm pretty scared of what could happen to my family.
There was something said along the lines of, if you're not going to do something about it, we will, or we're going to talk to people and we're going to take care of it.
Hello and welcome to Groundwire. This is Reagan Headley.
And I'm Matthew Joseph.
Groundwire is a grassroots news program brought to you by the National Campus and Community Radio Association.
This week, Groundwire was produced on traditional Anishinaabe and Métis territory at CKUW in Winnipeg, Manitoba. Coming up, a BC woman who was charged for her refusal to complete the 2011 census and a traditional Indigenous shaming ceremony on Falmon Eel.
As well as a community radio report on the 6th Annual Prisoners' Justice Day at CFRC in Kingston, Ontario.
That is all coming up on this edition of Groundwire. But first, here are the headlines.
A report released recently by the Canadian Civil Liberties Association says that the overuse of pretrial custody in Canada's bail system is slowing the judicial process, disproportionately affecting people from marginalized populations, infringing on the rights and freedoms of Canadians, and costing taxpayers too much money. The report, entitled Set Up to Fail, Bail and the Revolving Door of Pretrial Detention, critiques the sharp increase in the use of pretrial custody to detain people accused of crimes in Canada. And it also demonstrates that pretrial custody rates have risen almost 300% over the last three decades, in spite of a sharp decrease in crime over that same period. The CCLA says that the overuse of this practice contravenes the legislative intent of bail, which is to safeguard an individual's liberty and right to a fair trial. According to the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms, a person accused of a crime is considered innocent until proven guilty, and they have the right not to be denied reasonable bail without just cause. The law allows restrictions on these liberties only where it is absolutely necessary for public safety. Currently, almost 55% of people detained in provincial and territorial jails are legally innocent, waiting for their trial or determination of their bail, and more than two-thirds of this number have been charged with nonviolent or minor offenses. The report recommends a number of changes, including a requirement that bail conditions should not be arbitrary and be clearly related to the purposes of the bail system and the specific facts of the case, and a repeal of the reverse onus bail provisions in the Criminal Code, which places the onus on an accused person to prove they should not be detained if they are charged with failing to comply with previous release conditions.
This is Sarah Newton reporting from Toronto, where resistance to Canada's immigration detention policies, or lack thereof, is growing. Last Thursday in Toronto at a media conference, the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights released the official statement that Canada should immediately release a man who has been imprisoned for 8 years over immigration violations. The opinion is in response to a complaint by advocates on behalf of the immigration detainee Michael Mvogo, who has been held since his arrest in 2006 in Toronto. It is the first such opinion issued in a case involving Canada since 1994. The inability of a state party to carry out the expulsion of an individual does not justify detention beyond the shortest period of time, said the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights Working Group on Arbitrary Detentions. Although the Canadian government is not bound by the UN opinion to release Mvogo, the End Immigration Detention Network hopes it can pressure Ottawa to change its current immigration detention policy and align with other countries by limiting the detention to 90 days. Immigrants in a maximum security prison in Lindsay, Ontario, where Mr. Mvogo has been jailed, join illegal detainees in several other prisons in a strike ongoing since September 2013, calling for an end to detention. Their demands include an end to maximum security incarceration, an overhaul of the detention review process, and a 90-day limit on detention pending deportation. Dr. Celeste Thurwell is a psychiatrist who has been working for the last 4 years with Canadian immigration lawyers and refugees in refugee courts and detention centers.
Many of them are suffering already from traumatic events and have post-traumatic stress disorder from their countries of origin. And to be held against their will in high security prisons often triggers and reactivates flashbacks and other post-traumatic stress symptoms that come from their original traumas. So basically, these people are being re-traumatized. They were traumatized and victimized in their countries of origin, and they're being re-traumatized once they arrive in Canada. And many of them are handcuffed the moment they arrive, unable to understand the language that's being spoken to them, and brought directly to detention. Some of the people that I've interviewed in detention are actually mentally ill, and in fact they need treatment and support rather than further punishment and detention in high security prisons. Canada's lack of transparent policy is an embarrassment to our country. We're one of the few Western nations who actually does not have a clear policy and can hold our refugees in high security as long as even 10 years in some cases. This is a gross human rights violation. They haven't committed any crimes other than to try and save their lives by seeking refuge in what they thought would be a safer country.
That was Sarah Newton of Whistle Radio. The following headline comes from Rachel Swadick at the NCRA.
Dozens gathered on Parliament Hill for a traditional Indigenous copper-breaking ceremony on July 27th. A group of Indigenous people from across Canada traveled from British Columbia to Ottawa for the traditional shaming ceremony as part of the Awalaskanis 2 Journey on Truth and Unity.
Here's Sonny Wallace, who participated in the journey, explaining the ceremony.
The copper breaking is when a chief is mad, or if somebody did something wrong against that chief, then they would break a copper. And that person that they broke it for would have to have a potlatch or rectify the thing that they did wrong. And for us, we're breaking it against the government for Mother Earth, to try to protect Mother Earth.
The group of 21 people left British Columbia the first week of July, stopping in many communities before arriving at Ottawa July 26th. They explained copper breaking is an extreme and ancient tradition rarely seen outside of the Indigenous homelands in modern-day British Columbia. The group said they broke the copper because of human rights violations and environmental issues, especially current pipeline plans. The former president of the Council of the Haida Nation Guja made the copper for the ceremony.
We've taken our culture and expressed what we needed to express here. Eh? For us, it's we're done with this. We're whatever Harper does with it from here is his business, and really doesn't matter so much to us. You know, the fact is, within ourselves, we've taken care of that business, and we could move on.
According to a spokesperson for the Department of Public Works, the copper was picked up by the department and will be held in an Ottawa office for an undetermined period of time for anyone to claim. If it is not claimed, it is likely the copper will be disposed of.
That is all for headlines. You can visit us online at groundwire.ncra.ca.
And now for our feature stories.
At Groundwire production time on August 1st, deadly military assault between Israel and Hamas had been ongoing since July 8th. Rallies have taken place across the country to mourn the more than 1,360 people who have died in Gaza and put pressure on Israel to prevent future massacre. Aaron Lakoff has more from CKUT in Montreal. The opening audio is from a bombing in Gaza City, recorded on July 29th by Russia Today.
It is a conflict that has shaken people around the world, including here in Canada. The Israeli military assault on the illegally occupied Gaza Strip has claimed over 1,300 Palestinian lives, including more than 300 children, at the time of Groundwire production, according to the Gaza Health Ministry. Hamam Farah is a Palestinian-Canadian from Gaza who currently lives in Toronto. He says he fears for his family's safety.
This time, for the first time, I'm pretty scared of what could happen to my family. Just a few days ago, a family friend was killed, and her son's leg had to be amputated. And there was a funeral at the church for her. Since I'm part of the small Christian community in Gaza, who have opened up its church, the Orthodox Christian Church in Gaza, for Palestinians who are fleeing their homes by the hundreds of thousands now.
Protests have been growing in most major cities in Canada, calling for an end to the Israeli attacks. They've also drawn out large portions of the Palestinian diaspora in Canada. Here, Jasmine and Amal, two women from Gaza, speaking at a Palestinian solidarity rally in Montreal on July 16th.
So we are Palestinian. We are from Gaza. And it's just not fair what's happening to the kids, to the women, to the men. Mm-hmm. It's not fair what's going on.
And thinking about other people back home, yeah. I just want Canadians to like really step up and say, like, you know, it's not okay. It's not right what's happening. Anyone in their right mind that sees what's going on in Palestine is... It's bad. Like
it's really bad. It's really, really bad.
Everybody seems to listen to the media and listen to one side of the story. Everybody needs to like look at both sides of the stories, and that's what it is. Like, just educate yourself, do some research.
Amidst the attacks, activists across Canada have renewed their calls for the campaign of boycotts, divestments, and sanctions, or BDS, against Israel. The campaign comes from a call from 170 Palestinian civil society organizations launched in 2005. It is modeled after the Nonviolent International Campaign, which helped bring an end to apartheid in South Africa. In recent weeks, several prominent musicians added their names to the call and refused to perform in Israel, including hip-hop artist Talib Kweli and Chuck D of Public Enemy. Tyler Levitan of Independent Jewish Voices tells us why he thinks it's important to support BDS.
IJV was actually the first national Jewish organization in the world to endorse the BDS movement. We've seen other Jewish groups follow suit and an increasing number of people around the world supporting this nonviolent call from Palestinians. So I think it's extremely important, and I think that it's a very exciting time to be part of this movement. Because it is growing very, very quickly.
Several Canadian student organizations have endorsed BDS in recent years, including the York Federation of Students, the McMaster Student Association, ASSE in Quebec, and the Graduate Student Union at Concordia. These organizations say their universities should cut all ties with Israeli academic institutions. According to a report by the Alternative Information Center in Israel, nearly all Israeli universities are used to conduct weapons research for the army. Many Palestine solidarity groups across Canada are determined to continue protesting until an enduring ceasefire is reached and Israel ends its blockade of the Gaza Strip. In addition, they are hoping that Canada will join the ranks of countries like Brazil and Chile and cut diplomatic ties with Israel. But with the Harper government throwing its full support behind Israel and opposition parties following suit, it could be a long struggle. For Groundwire, this is Aaron Lakoff from CKUT Radio in Montreal.
At this year's Winnipeg Fringe Festival, Lies of a Promiscuous Woman asked the question, "What if the Virgin Mary made it up?" The program received mixed reactions from Fringe-goers. On July 24th, CKUW's Femisphere interviewed Teresa Thompson, the actor who played the show's Virgin Mary. Anna Sigrether and Jen Unwin from CKUW bring you this story.
You're listening to Femisphere on CKUW 95.9 FM. I'm Anna.
I'm Jen.
And joining us by phone, we have Teresa Thompson.
Good morning.
Good morning.
So your Fringe play has been drawing ire. Can you tell us a little bit about this?
Yes. Everybody wants their Fringe show to stand out. Believe me when I say we did not want this kind of standing out. So it started with somebody writing just slut on my poster. And the poster happens to be my face. And I am appearing in character as the Virgin Mary. And the show is called Lies of a Promiscuous Woman. And the combination of the word promiscuous and the Virgin Mary has made at least one person outrageously upset. So it went from there to a bunch of posters with blasphemy written across them. In the Fringe program, under warnings, we have strong language and blasphemy.
Right. Blasphemy, okay.
So yeah, we don't deny that. Where the script sort of changed. One of my producers, it's a co-production.
Okay.
He has his own website, and anybody who wants to post on that website or on those blogs or comment goes to him for approval.
Okay.
And he started to get quite a few messages that were really angry and hateful. That escalated again to whenever, I shouldn't say whenever, but several times when I was around my venue. The venue we were given this year was at U of W.
Mm-hmm.
If I was by myself, somebody would scream at me.
Wow.
And there was more than one voice, but each incident it was only a single word, usually. And the top three words were blasphemer, whore, and slut.
So I just want to clarify this. They're calling you these words because the play is about the Virgin Mary not being a virgin, right?
Well, yes. I mean, the play is about misogyny and this relationship between women and society.
Mm-hmm.
I am not the playwright. The playwright is Audra Lozowski, and she's written this play about women and about power and about how this plays out. And she's put it on the backdrop of one of the most powerful, popular women in history. And then she's asked, what if?
Well, whatever happened to, if you don't like the show, don't go see it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this has been taken beyond.
Well, it got worse. Apparently, there were two gentlemen who approached members of the Fringe, and they were demanding that he shut down Lies of a Promiscuous Woman, or they were, both of them.
Mm.
And the Fringe responded in all the usual ways. It's an unjuried festival, and we have no say in the content of the show. So long as it's not illegal, they can do it and know it's fine.
Yeah.
When it got to the point in the conversation where I guess the two gentlemen realized they weren't going to get an answer they wanted, what I've heard is, and I'm paraphrasing, there was something said along the lines of, if you're not going to do something about it, we will, or we're going to talk to people and we're going to take care of it or something. Mm. It was the day after that or 2 days after that conversation, I had my car parked down in Old Market Square, seeing another show, got back to my car and somebody had written slut, but on my car, right over the door handle, like right where I would see it.
Like,
of
course,
very
yeah.
clear. Yeah.
Like in the dust on your window or like with a...
Oh, with a Sharpie. Yeah, this was just over the poster. It was very clear. They were not seeing the show or having an issue with the show. There are so many people in my life, including relatives, who I'm very close with, who are Roman Catholic or practicing Christians of one type. They've all seen the show, and they all love the show. We've gotten standing O's, ovations after every show.
I know it's Femisphere, so I gotta ask.
Yeah.
How much of this harassment and the hating not by the haters is, in your opinion, because you are a woman?
Yeah, that was suggested first off with the slut posters and things like that, and yeah, because you're a woman. I did discount it. That said, and somebody pointed out the picture is provocative. Pardon me, and it's a strong female image, and I'm staring right into the camera.
Okay.
And what was explained to me is, if you are that kind of man where that is scary, that poster is terrifying.
Okay.
And if you feel that Our Lady is not promiscuous, and how dare the show, that's going to get you very angry. The fact that the top two words of attack have been slut and whore.
Right.
And the fact that out of all of the shows, over 170 in the Winnipeg Fringe, all of the ones that contain religion just this year, in my 14 years of experience, including other fringes in Canada, all of the religious imagery I've seen in so many other shows, because every year it's a very popular topic, I have never, ever heard of this happening before.
That was Fringe performer and Winnipeg actor Teresa Thompson speaking to CKUW's Femisphere. The following headline comes from Connie Harrop at CJMP in Powell River, British Columbia.
On July 17th in Powell River, British Columbia, the trial for yoga teacher and active community member Karen Eve Stigenga was completed after a lengthy process by the government to criminally charge Stigenga for her refusal to fill out the 2011 short-form version of the census. Her refusal was considered a violation of Section 31 from the Statistics Act. CJMP's Courtney Harrop spoke with Stigenga about her experience.
I was a little bit curious what was going on with the census, so I did some research and I found out that in 2000, and I believe it was 03 or 04, the Canadian government had contracted Lockheed Martin for processing some of the software for the Canadian censuses. And that set off alarm bells in me because I'm very familiar with Lockheed Martin. They're an arms producer, as well as technology and data producer, and I was really concerned with their involvement in any way with the Canadian government and with the collection of, or anything to do with the collection of our personal information. I decided not to fill out the census at that time.
And so they never actually sent any officers to your door to arrest you, but you were criminally charged through the court system.
Yes.
That was quite a process that you went through, and I was able to be there for some of your hearings and your pretrial hearings. Do you want to speak a little bit about what the court process was like for you going through that as a, you know, a community member of Powell River, someone you're pretty well known in the community, having to go through essentially a trial about the census? What was that like for you?
It was really stressful. I first received notice in September of the last year. It was the 20th of September, because I remember I had a court date for the 25th of September, so I had 5 days notice that I was receiving a criminal charge and needed to appear in court. It gave me like a little bit of the charge, but I didn't have any details about it. I didn't know what to do. I've never been charged with anything before. I've never been to court before this, so it was my first time. And then I decided that it would just be better for me to represent myself, because then I could be my own voice and I didn't have to trust or not trust somebody else to speak on my behalf. And at the end of the sentencing, after she handed the sentencing, the judge said, she wanted to say a few words, and she said that your community is really lucky to have you. She was really impressed with my level of professionalism and with how organized I was and with how well I presented the information, even though I'm not a lawyer. And I really did try the best that I could to follow this system, which makes no sense, apparently makes logical sense, depending on, you know, whose definition of logic it is. And then the judge said that she also really appreciated my passion for morals and ethics and beliefs, and not to lose that. I felt like I won in those words. And Lockheed Martin is out of the census. From the Audrey Tobias trial, Yves Belland took the stand. It came out under oath that Lockheed Martin is no longer a part of the census. But one of the things I think is really important for people to see is, like, standing up and saying something can make a change and does make a change. If we just sit around and we talk about things all the time, that's great, but no change is going to happen unless we do something. And for me, from this, it was non-compliance. It was a non-violent act of simply stepping out of a process and not complying. That was my way of expressing.
I appreciate you having the time to sit and talk with me and with CJMP.
No problem. So. It's my pleasure. When you empower yourself, you just empower people around you, too, to stand in their truth. I think it's really, really important for us all.
Stiganga was ultimately found guilty and given a conditional discharge, which includes 9 months probation and 25 hours of community service, despite arguments that her charter rights to freedom of conscience had been violated.
You were just listening to Courtney Harrop of CJMP, and now for Groundwire's Community Radio Report. 2014 marks the sixth year that CFRC has provided programming on Prisoners' Justice Day. The station welcomes contributions, requests, messages, and suggestions from people who know or are supportive of prisoners in the Kingston area, or from people who are incarcerated in other Canadian communities. Messages and song requests will be shared live between 3 and 6 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on Sunday, August 10th. Visit www.cfrc.ca for contact information. Here's Brenna Owen of CFRC speaking to Christiana and Cameron on the origins and purpose of Prisoners' Justice Day.
My first very basic question is if you could just, in a few words, explain what Prisoners' Justice Day is.
So Prisoners' Justice Day began in the 1970s at Millhaven Institution, just outside of Kingston, as a memorial day to remember a prisoner who had died in the institution the year previously. And since that time, it's been recognized by prisoners and people working in solidarity with prisoners on the outside internationally as primarily a day to remember all those who have died natural deaths behind bars, but also a time to raise awareness about the conditions in our prisons and the experiences of prisoners who are undergoing incarceration.
What history with Prisoners' Justice Day does CFRC have?
We began with a Prisoners' Justice Day broadcast on August 10th, 2009, and it was quite successful. We had a lot of positive feedback from prisoners in the area as well as from listeners on the outside. And so we've continued to do that annually. And then several years ago, volunteers involved with Prisoners' Justice Day programming actually launched a weekly program that airs on CFRC as well, which is called CPR, And that's a Wednesday evening, 7 to 8 p.m. program that addresses prisons and prison issues.
So what's in store for this year's Prisoners Justice Day programming?
We have some interviews lined up with author Stephen Reed, who's a very well-known writer and a former prisoner who spent, I think, over 20 years behind bars in Canadian institutions. We have an interview with Kate Johnson, a former prison chaplain at Pittsburgh Institution just outside of Kingston, and an interview with Chris Brown, a local musician who has worked with Prisoners on the Inside to create a music album.
And we'll be broadcasting content from a rally that's going to be held that day by EPIC and the Prison Industrial Complex, a group in Kingston that campaigns against prisons. And we'll also be doing a three-hour request show that will play messages, letters, and song requests sent in from inmates or their families in the Kingston area.
And we also have a collaboration with our sister station, CFRU in Guelph. They have some volunteers working around prison issues and are going to be contributing a segment on the voices of those undergoing immigration detention in Ontario.
I was going to ask, actually, have you explored any other programming that is specific to certain issues within prisons, for example, gender, or, as you just mentioned, immigration?
Over the 6 years that this program has been running, we've covered a wide range of issues affecting prisoners and also different communities that are disproportionately affected by incarceration in the criminal justice system. So, for example, there's extreme overrepresentation of Indigenous communities in the prison system. There's also extreme hardship faced by queer and transgendered prisoners working, trying to survive within the binary prison system. You know, the plight of women prisoners, many of whom find themselves caught up in the system due to defending themselves or trying to survive within abusive partnerships. So we certainly have, over the years, covered a diversity of those topics, as well as this year our focus on immigration detention, but also getting the individual voices and stories of current and former prisoners out, as well as sharing messages of support and the experiences of people who work in solidarity with prisoners.
What's kind of the relationship between community radio and Prisoners Justice Day, or perhaps even similar events and programming surrounding them?
Well, probably the longest running prison-related program in community radio in Canada is the Stark Raven program based out of Vancouver Co-op Radio. They've been on the air for over 25 years. There's also a fairly long-standing prison radio program at CKUT in Montreal, and then this newer program coming out of CFRU in Guelph. CKUW in Winnipeg has also created programming around prisons and prison issues, as has the station in, I think, Waterloo, but not in the context of a regular weekly program that's dedicated to focusing on prisons and prison issues.
I was going to add, though, I mean, and it makes sense as well, that a lot of campus and community stations are so involved in Prisoners Justice Day and prison radio because of the nature of our mandate to help bring to light the voices of those who are not normally heard. And our mainstream media environment is extraordinarily law and order focused. And while that is an important side to hear often, especially dealing with victims, the voices of prisoners are very rarely heard on the radio.
That was all for this edition of Gunwire from CKUW in Winnipeg, Manitoba. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Matthew Joseph.
And I'm Reagan Headley. We thank contributors Catherine Fisher, Sarah Newton, Rachel Swadek, Aaron Lakoff, Courtney Harrop, Jen Unwin, Anna Sigurther, and Brenna Owen. We would also like to thank Victoria King, Rael Gauthier, and Eric Januzzi.
Tune in again to hear Gunwire on your local community radio station, or download this and past episode at gunwire.ncra.ca. Gunwire is a project of the National Campus and Community Radio Association.